Welcome to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz, a candid conversation as we learn about types of dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, frontal temporal, and Lewy body, and the effects on the people we love. Jill's years of dedication and experience help you adapt, overcome obstacles, and find positive outcomes. It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Hi, friends. Well, the last week or so, the world has been mourning the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What a woman. Oh my gosh. I hope that as you're listening to this, you are a fan of her. If you're not, you might want to turn this off because I am. And I'm going to talk today about her life and what she has meant to us as a country, as women, as people looking for equality, as caregivers. She tried a case years ago that I'm going to discuss that changed the scope of how caregivers are seen. And gender inequality that needed to be modified. And she made a difference. She changed the way our country looks at caregivers as a whole. And so I want to talk about her today. And I'm deeply saddened by her death. She was a Supreme Court justice from the time she was 60 years old until she passed away at 87. And I think that the movie that portrayed her life on the basis of sex, that's what it was called, and the people that starred in it was Felicity Jones as RBG, and Armie Hammer played her husband. And I thought that they just did an absolutely amazing job of just showing the way that she came up through the ranks, the way she pushed and pushed and pushed to be recognized as a lawyer, not a female lawyer. And she was it, man. I'm telling you, she was it. She was the one who started it for women everywhere to be able to go up in front of the Supreme Court and present her case. And I mean, it was just amazing to watch her early years and the way that she was denied a career that she deserved and that, you know, she desired as a lawyer. And in the 1950s, it did not stop her. I mean, she just pushed through and single-handedly changed the outdated American legal system, which just spent all of its time repressing women and denying all of us equality. I mean, they really did. I mean, she was amazing. And I am just absolutely full of admiration for this lady. I am. I love the movie. I am amazed still to this day that she was ever named a Supreme Court justice. You know, I mean, in a time when mediocrity is lauded and applauded. Yeah, really? Like, okay, I can't get off on a political tangent, can I? But this was something seriously to cheer about. The way that she charted her life, the way she wanted her life to go, and how she put a plan. You know, I'm big on talking about plans. She put a plan in place for her to be a woman who attended Harvard Law School. They didn't want her there. She was denied to be at Harvard Law School, and she fought that. She fought that and was able to finally get in. She was the only female of all males. And she sat there in classes. She worked her tail off. She met her husband there. And at that point, they he ended up getting cancer very, very young in their relationship. And she ended up going to his classes when he was in the hospital with cancer and took classes for not only herself but his classes and completed those for him so that he could get his law degree. And then when all that was over with, you know, they told her that, you know, she could be at Harvard and she could continue to get her education there, but there would be some restrictions on it. And she basically flipped him the bird and said, you know, screw you, I'll go to Columbia. And she went to Columbia and graduated top in her class. Top in her class. Like, what a woman. I mean, she was amazing. And one of the first cases that she was actually able to put in front of the Supreme Court was a gender discrimination suit that related to the internal tax revenue folks. And she was saying, hey, this internal revenue tax law is unconstitutional. And when she went in front of this all white male Supreme Court, you know, group, she was arguing that a man who had stayed home and taken care of his wife, who was dying of cancer and had some dementia going on, that he was denied having a tax deduction because he was a man. And at that time, they didn't think it was right for a man to be at home taking care of his wife. He should have been at work, and she should have just taken care of herself, or other female family members should have stepped in. And she stood up in front of this all-male Supreme Court and fought against the inequality of caregivers everywhere that are male. Now imagine that. And she was saying, our job as women is not to stay at home and just look pretty and fix dinner and raise kids. We can be out working. We can do what we need to do. That was a main crux of her premise and the laws and the equality that she pushed for years and years. But her very first case against the Supreme Court or to the Supreme Court was a male caregiver that she was fighting for. I think that's awesome. I just think that's awesome. And at that time, literally, the Supreme Court had never invalidated any type of gender-based law and had rejected every challenge put forth to them, every single one. They did not recognize it. They didn't want to talk about it. We don't have to deal with this. You know, we're not even going to talk about it. And she won. She won, and she anticipated that they were going to fight her on it. So she used a precedent that could be used to challenge 178 federal laws, which discriminated on the basis of sex at that time. That's where the movie got its name, right? And, you know, I mean, that's pretty amazing. She literally went through 178 cases of federal laws which discriminated on the basis of sex at that time and said, you can't do it now. We're going to change this. And she ended up bringing five more cases of this type. She won 5 of 6. But she changed the scope of how we would look at social culture that saw men as breadwinners and women as caregivers. For that, I applaud her. I just think it was amazing, amazing that she had the wherewithal to do it. She had the kahunas to get up there and talk to them when she knew they were going to speak down to her. I mean, I just thought it was an excellent, excellent portrayal of her as a woman and the times that she's been, you know, applauded and recognized as changing. I mean, it's just, it amazes me how she was turned down to work at any law firm for like 4 years. From the time she got married to the time that, you know, her child was 4 years old, she had one law firm after another telling her that instead of teaching law and practicing in court, that she needed to be home being a good wife and mommy, right? And everybody was seeing what she couldn't do. They limited what her abilities were, which is just ridiculous, right? And that was a chance for feminism to rise again, to rise up and say, you know, hey, it's important that we got the chance to vote. That's really great. But now we want to be paid the same as men. We want to be recognized that we can do as good of a job as men. She literally opened the door. She opened the door for women to have equal pay and be recognized and applauded for having a brain and being able to do the job that anybody else could do. Just look at us as qualified candidates, not whether or not we're male or female, right? And I really think that movie was so poignant when this caregiver was being prosecuted, essentially, for claiming on taxes that she and her husband, Marty, had taken an opportunity to make a mockery of the court, right? And really just get in there and say, this has to be fair for everybody. And we have to apply it as a new law the way that we've applied it to laws of the past. And really just treat people like they should be treated. I mean, that's amazing. That's amazing. So in the scope of things, she wasn't the first woman to be appointed a Supreme Court justice. She was the second, actually. But that's all right. And currently, up until her death, she was the oldest member. I think that's pretty surprising. But she lived to be 87. She wasn't even appointed to the Supreme Court until she was 60 years old. I think that's pretty amazing. I think, you know, I've heard recently that there's been some pretty persuasive arguments that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was essentially the Thurgood, I can never say his name, Thurgood Marshall, please forgive me, Thurgood Marshall of the women's movement. Okay? I really think she was. Because, like I told you, about the five that she won and the six that she presented to the Supreme Court in the 1970s when she was first finally able to get up and fight for this, all of them were dealing directly with the issue of women's equality under the law and even men's inequality under the law. And she was to women's rights what Thurgood Marshall was to civil rights, both as a lawyer and as a member of the Supreme Court. I really think that it was like so ridiculous that even after graduating at the top of her class, she had trouble getting a job. She found herself getting paid much, much less than her male colleagues. And those injustices really just turned into the passion and what helped form the focus of her entire life work. I think that's important because, you know, they say if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. I have to say that's kind of ridiculous because I love what I do, but some days it feels like work. But in any case, I think that just the way that she, as a person, as a wife and a mother, and you know, a fellow attorney with her husband, Marty. She showed that you could be not only a wife and a mom, but you could be a working woman. And I just think that that's, I just really think that that's poignant to bring out, because we look at things now and our openness, our ability to, you know, be a CEO of a company or be a partner in a law firm seem like it's always been around. Well, it hasn't always been around. We've had to have people who blaze those trails for us. And it's not lost on me that this 5'1" woman was was the first person to ever go through Harvard Law School and went on to be the first in her class at another prestigious university and still couldn't get a job. Yeah, I mean, if we look back at that and say, man, that was 1970. That wasn't that long ago. I started high school in 1976. 76, I graduated in 80. So that puts it into perspective for me. So that wasn't, I mean, literally, that wasn't long, just 6 years. So I would have been in, like, grade school when she did all this. That is amazing to me, because it just really, truly, I think, puts it into perspective that it wasn't that long ago. I'm not that old, right? I'm not that old. Oh, my goodness. And then moving on, after she became just this badass lawyer and was getting up in everybody's face and throwing all of her cases at the Supreme Court and saying, look at me, I know what I'm talking about, and you better start working with me. And she was able to do that. Finally, it was, you know, finally in a second unusual move, a president was able to nominate a 60-year-old person for the Supreme Court, and it was her. Usually they look for someone younger, you know, more likely to last 30 productive years or whatever. But Bill Clinton, for his good things and his bad things, he said in an on-camera interview that he knew minutes into their conversation that Ginsburg would be his choice for the Supreme Court nominee. And I tell you what, if he didn't do anything else in his presidency, I love that he nominated her and that she was able to be put in place and last all these years. 27 years she was on the Supreme Court. Up until the day she died, she was still working on Supreme Court cases. I just think that's amazing. I think something that's even more amazing is after that movie came out, I think it was like 2008, 2009, something like that, she kind of became a pop culture figure, right? And she got an adulation that was really only part tongue-in-cheek. She'd been given a hip-hop moniker, it just cracks me up to say this, Notorious RBG. And it was a play on I don't want to say he was a gangster, but the gangsta rap kind of guy, Notorious B.I.G. And the notion of Ginsburg, who's been quiet and reserved like her entire life, being compared to this big, blustering rap star, I think was absolutely hilarious. You know, it was just kind of funny. It's an underlying joke. And Ginsburg has acknowledged that she's been playing a game, essentially, a very long game her entire life. She thinks strategically. She thinks incrementally. And no one in America, big, loud, flashy, or otherwise, could have done it better than she did. I mean, I'm telling you. I just love that she was such a dedicated person to the plight of of people who were disrespected and not taken seriously, and was always willing at her 5'1" stature to stand tall, to stand really tall in the eyes of the law, and to continue to fight for people to make sure that we were equal. And I'm telling you, the thing is, it's striking to me right now with everything that's going on in our country. We are only a half an inch away every day, all the time, at any moment, of having equality taken away from us. For a person that fought her entire life for equality for people, we're still not there yet. We're not there yet. As long as we have Americans who feel disrespected, that feel targeted, and hey, I'm talking about everybody here. I'm talking about everybody here. I'm talking about black people. I'm talking about police officers, you know, but there is still a healthy bit of racism issues in our country. We have them in big cities. We have them in small towns. But there is racism in our country, and we need to deal with it. And she actually took on all of those things throughout her legal career, talking about how she thought all this played out. So I thought it would be kind of interesting to bring up some things today on the show about her that maybe some of you don't know, okay? So she was so dedicated to the law that she always kept a pocket constitution in her handbag. I think that's kind of funny. But I'm going to go through a couple of her major rulings that I think that some of you might find interesting. So in 1996, she had a case, United States versus Virginia, in which she wrote the majority opinion striking down Virginia's military institute's traditional male-only policy. No women allowed. No women allowed. The 7-1 ruling said that the VMI, the Virginia Military Institute, violated the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. And she said, "Woman seeking and fit for VMI quality education cannot be offered anything less under the state's obligation to afford them genuinely equal protection." And guess what? She won. Now there are women in the state of Virginia's military. How do you like that? I think that's a pretty good one. In 1997, in United States versus O'Hagan, in which she wrote, "A person who trades in securities," meaning, you know, stocks and bonds and stuff like that, "personal profit, using confidential information misappropriated in a breach of a fiduciary duty to the source of the information," and that was a quote, "can be found guilty of violating the Securities and Exchange Commission rules." Now, why was that big? That was big because she's saying if you're in trading, if you are in the Security and Exchange Commissions, you can't just put money where you want. You can't just pay people to do what you need them to do. You can't buy out senators and presidents and things like that so that you can make money. Not cool. And she presented that and actually won the case. That's huge because in the Security and Exchange Commission rules, prior to that, anybody could buy anybody to get any law changed that they wanted to. And you could just pay out money just to get your person nominated or what have you. Well, we still fight about that. We still, you know, point it out when somebody's using, you know, big companies or organizations like the NRA backing a certain president or something like that, as just as an example. That's where we have so much corruption and crap going on and people meeting each other in alleys and secret meetings and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, that brings us right back to the whole Nixon thing, right? So, you know, she just presented that and said, this can't happen. This cannot happen. And we can thank her for the fact that maybe some of the trades and associations and Securities and Exchange and Wall Street and all that can't screw us over anymore. So good for you, Ruth. I hope that you rest in peace on that one, sister. I think that was a really good one. We have enough corruption going on in this country. We needed somebody to call a halt to it, and I thought she just rocked that one. That was pretty amazing. Yeah. So I'm going to take a short break, and I'm going to come back with some of the other really amazing cases that she presented to the courts and that made a difference and changed America as we know it. We'll be right back.
Living and working with Alzheimer's and other dementias can often be challenging. Summit Resilience Training provides education utilizing non-medical approaches for those who work with our friends affected by dementia. Believing families still need one-on-one assistance, we provide classes which help them understand the diseases affecting their loved ones, offering strategies and techniques for success with activities of daily living and working with confusing behaviors. We offer in-home assessments to clarify symptoms of dementia diseases and help families work together to find moments of joy while living with memory loss and impairment. Education programs instilling person-centered care philosophies are offered for professional caregivers working in communities and homes, which can be customized for their staff. Training is also available for first responders, such as law enforcement, fire, and EMT personnel. We are passionate that people with dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others, are approached with compassion and understanding, and those who work with them have all the tools they need for success. Call us at Summit Resilience Training, 303-420-6988, to schedule a class or in-home assessment. Visit our website at summitresiliencetraining.com for more information.
Welcome back to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Okay, so I'm talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her contribution to our country. Not just with laws and different cases that she was able to bring forth, but who she was and how she was a trailblazer for women and attorneys and caregivers and people with disabilities and anybody who was treated with inequality. She was a champion. And when she saw something that she didn't think was right, she stood up and she fought against it. And I just wanted so bad today. I know it really doesn't have much to do with, you know, any dementias or anything like that, except for that very first case that she won. But it matters. And I just wanted to take time today to say, if you didn't know a lot about her, if you're wondering why everybody's making all this hoopla about her, I want to give you some reasons why. I want you to walk away from today's show going, hey, I didn't know that, right? And I just feel like I was glad that the movie On the Basis of Sex was ever even produced and put forward, because I've often wondered why we don't celebrate people while they're still alive. Like, I think we ought to have a day that we, every day of the year, where we celebrate somebody who's just rocked it, that's just done something fantastic. Let's celebrate them now while they're still alive and they know we appreciate them, right? Wouldn't that be cool? I think that'd be totally cool. So, you know, she passed away and I never got a chance to meet her. Man, I wish I would have. I just thought she was just an amazing woman. So I wanted to go through some of the cases that she worked on, that she presented to the Supreme Court before she was a Supreme Court justice, and what a difference it made. And this is a big one. This is a big one. In 1999, Olmstead versus LC decision, in which she said, states under the Americans for Disability Act, which, by the way, was brought forth in 1964. 1964. That's just a little tidbit that y'all should know. Way back then, I was 3 years old, they were talking about how we needed to make sure we had wheelchair ramps and all kinds of stuff, right? But she was saying in the decision that states under the American for Disabilities Act, quote, are required to place persons with mental disabilities in community settings rather than institutions. When the state's treatment for professionals have determined that community placement is appropriate, the transfer from institutional care to a less restrictive setting is not opposed by the affected individual, and the placement can be reasonably accommodated, taking into account the resources available to the state and the needs of others with mental disabilities, end quote. Do you know what that means, people? Do you know what that means? That's where she said, we've got to stop putting people that have, like, Alzheimer's, Lewy body, frontal temporal, which we've known about since 1960, we have to stop putting them in institutional funny farms, the insane asylums that we used to call them, right? And now they have a right to go and live in a community that is like a nursing home with a memory unit. And not only that, but people that had Down syndrome or, you know, head injuries and things like that, that they did not have to be mandated to state facilities any longer, that they could now go to nursing homes and other accommodating places, you know, nursing homes, assisted livings, things like that, or skilled nursing homes, skilled nursing. They could go to those places instead of being put in state institutions. And because of her changes on that, people with Down syndrome, especially, were now looked at as people who were per se normal. Okay, so now people would keep their folks with Down syndrome at home instead of putting them in an institution. They were treated more like people. This was broad reaching. This was huge. It was huge because she was saying we got to stop treating these people like they're an enigma, like they've got the plague or something, right? They're not a leper. Stop this. We're going to change this. And these people have a right to have accommodations that are humane and that are better than humane, that are treating them with dignity and treating them like they are people. She changed the scope of how people with Alzheimer's especially are treated in this country. God bless her. I mean, I'm telling you, that was huge. That was absolutely huge. All right, moving on to another one. In the 2000 Friends of the Earth versus Laidlaw Environmental Services ruling, Ginsburg majority opinion said residents in the area of the North Tiger River in South Carolina had standing to sue Laidlaw based on the argument that its pollution prevented them from using the waterway for recreation. That was pretty big as well. I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with dementia or anything like that, but for God's sakes, people have a right to be in water that's not polluted. There are places in this country right now, in fact, there's one in Southern California, where our Navy SEALs are having to work and train in polluted waters, and it's affecting their health. Oh my gosh. I mean, I'm telling you, that law changed it for the people of South Carolina. They need to use that same precedent and fight that same law for these guys that are trying to defend our country and have their training in the Marines and the Navy to be able to train and stuff in places that are sanitary, for goodness sakes. Well, anyway, in 2000, she won a big case for the people of South Carolina. Here was one that I thought was like really, really amazing. I tried to pull some good ones for you today so you could understand who she was. She had lung cancer. This woman had lung cancer, right? And during the time when she was recovering from lung surgery, she wrote the 2019 ruling in Timms versus Indiana that the Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive fines applies to states and local governments, not just federal government. Okay? At issue was the confiscation of a $42,000 Land Rover from an Indiana man who pleaded guilty to selling $225 of heroin to undercover officers. And she said, quote, "For good reason, the protection against the excessive fines has been a constant shield throughout the Anglo-American history. Exorbitant tolls undermine other constitutional liberties," end quote. Ginsburg wrote in the 9-0 ruling, "Excessive fines can be used, for example, to retaliate against or chill the speech of political enemies." That was kind of a crazy one. But the bottom line on that is that what she was trying to say is you can't, in this particular case, you couldn't just sue like the federal government. If you had to sue somebody, you could sue a state government as well for things that they do wrong. And sometimes states do things wrong. Now, this was sort of a wacky case of a guy that was, they took his Land Rover because he was in the act of selling drugs to an undercover cop. But in the long run, he didn't feel like they should have kept his Land Rover. And she took the case and said, you know, hey, I guess, you know, on city and state level, we ought to be able to say this isn't quite fair. If he's going to go to jail or if he's going to be charged with selling the heroin, that's one thing. But do you need to take his property? You know, as wacky as that is, I think that they were right about the fact that you know, you don't need to lose the farm just because you did something wrong, you know? I just think that's kind of funny. Now, some of the most memorable opinions she had, you may or may not like, depending on your political stance or moral stance or whatever, but I'm going to just kind of read a couple of them off. So in Gonzalez versus Carhart, in which the court in 2007 upheld the Congress's partial birth abortion ban of 2003. And what that was about was opponents of the ban contended that the procedure, also known as intact dilation and extraction, was the safest way to avoid damaging a woman's uterus when ending a late-term pregnancy. This was the first time that the court had banned a specific abortion method and the first time it did not include an exception for the woman's health. And that was according to the Washington Post. You know, that's a touchy one. Take it or leave it. I'm not going to go too deep into that one because it is what it is. But that really was more based on a woman having trouble with a pregnancy that could result in the woman's death. And like it or not, she took up for the woman to be able to say this could be a result of the woman dying and the baby dying, so maybe one of them should be saved. However you feel about that, you feel about it. But I just thought it was an interesting case. Okay. So writing for the majority in the 5-4 decision, Justice Anthony Kennedy said Congress may regulate an area where doctors have not reached a consensus about the necessity of the procedure in protecting the woman's health. Respondents have not demonstrated that the act, as a facial matter, is void of vagueness or that it imposes an undue burden on a woman's right to abortion based on the overbreadth or lack of a health exception. It was pretty interesting. You know, she said in her dissent that the majority ruling tolerates, indeed applauds, federal intervention to ban nationwide a procedure found necessary and proper in certain cases by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. In candor, she said, the act and the court's defense of it cannot be understood as anything other than an effort to chip away at the right declared again and again by this court with an increasing comprehension of its centrality to women's lives. And then she added, the court deprives women of the right to make an autonomous choice, even at the expense of their own safety. This way of thinking reflects ancient notions about women's place in the family and under the Constitution, ideas that have been long discredited. You know, I'm telling you, I would rather have somebody stand up and say, hey, maybe this isn't a good situation and we need to modify what we're thinking about it. It's touchy, but again, it is what it is. Okay, one more. I'm going to give you one or two more, I think, here before we get done for the day. But she was also among the four justice minority in 2007, Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, and she took the rare step of reading her dissent from the bench. The majority ruled against Lilly Ledbetter in her claim of unequal pay because of her sex. As an area manager, Ledbetter was paid $3,727 per month compared with $4,286 for the lowest paid male counterpart. The majority on the court did not rule on the merits of Ledbetter's claim made under the Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The five justices rejected it on the grounds that it was filed too long from the time of the original decision and was made after the decision was made about her pay. Citing the often secret nature of the salary levels, Ginsburg said, in our view, the court does not comprehend or is indifferent to the insidious way that in which women can be victims of pay discrimination. So she left it in the Congress's court, and she was pretty ticked off about that. 2 years later, Congress took an action passing the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which said each discriminatory paycheck resets the 180-day limit to file a claim. It was the first law signed by President Barack Obama. And Ginsburg was so freaking happy about it, she kept a framed copy of the 2009 law on her wall in her chambers. I love that one. I can't even deny it. So what happened was essentially that they reset. There was a 180-day limit for somebody to file a legal claim that they had been discriminated again on the basis of pay, women specifically, to men. And she did not like the ruling, so she just kept pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, threw it back to Congress, and got the law changed. She participated in getting the law changed so that there was no time limit on women having to get in their lawsuit, you know, in a timely fashion, like less than 180 days, in order to say, hey, I've been discriminated against and I'm doing the same job as this guy and I'm doing it just as well and he's making $1,000 more than I am. And when they got it passed, she was so excited about it, she put a copy of the law on her wall. I love that. I love that. All right, here's a big one that many of you may recognize. In the 2014 Burwell versus Hobby Lobby Stores. Okay, the court for the first time recognized a for-profit corporation's claim of religious belief. The store chain owned by the Evangelical Green family challenged an Affordable Care Act mandate that employers cover the cost of certain contraceptives for their female employees. In a 5-4 ruling, the High Court ruled that the mandate violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. In her dissent, Ginsburg said, until this litigation, no decision in the court recognized for a recognized a for-profit corporation's qualification for a religious exemption from a generally applicable law. Whether under the free exercise clause of RFRA, the absence of such precedents is just what one would expect. For the exercise of religion is characteristic of natural persons, not artificial legal entities. Approving some religious claims while deeming others unworthy of accommodation could be perceived as favoring one religion over another. And that, she said, is very risky and designed to preclude. The court, I fear, has ventured into a minefield. Boy, she wasn't kidding. She wasn't kidding. And you know, those same companies, Chick-fil-A, there's a bookstore. I forgot what it's called, but it's right next door to all Hobby Lobbies for the most part. They're owned by the same people. They all, don't work on Sundays. And in this particular case, they are adamantly against abortion and abortion rights. And no matter how you feel about that, what they were saying in that lawsuit was that they don't feel like they should have to pay in their ownership taxes. Because when you own your company, like I own my own company, you have to pay like unemployment benefits and workman comp benefits and everything else. At the time that that case went forth in 2014, companies were being forced to pay for contraceptives for people and having to pay for their birth control, essentially. And they were mad about it. So however you see that, it went to court. And basically what happened was Hobby Lobby won the right to not have to pay for contraception for people. Anyway, it was just kind of an interesting case, I thought, and one that is pertinent to our world today. And so here's another one. In another minefield, the outcome of the 2000 presidential election between George W. Bush and Democrat Al Gore was thrust into the court's domain following the chaotic rules in Florida. Oh, we all remember that, right? Florida had all kinds of problems with their polling and stuff like that. By one vote, 5-4, the Supreme Court abruptly stopped a vote recount ordered by the Florida Supreme Court. In her dissent, Ginsburg criticized the majority's willingness to interpret the Florida law. And she said, the extraordinary setting of this case has obscured the ordinary principle that dictates its proper resolution. Federal courts defer to states' high courts' interpretations of their own state laws, meaning, essentially, that they need to let the states decide what the heck they want to do. This principle reflects the core of federalism on which we all agree. And I thought that was pretty interesting that she would say, you know, we were the other members of this court as mindful as they generally are of our system of dual sovereignty, they would affirm the judgment of the Florida Supreme Court. So essentially what she was trying to say about that was that the states ought to have a right to do what they want to do. The feds should not be in everybody's business. And that has transcended to many other cases and laws that have come forth across the country that use that as a precedent, that states, state by state, ought to be able to mandate their own laws and rules. Specifically, where that would have affected, say, my state and many across the country is when they started making rules that they could have pot shops and stuff like that in various states, and Colorado was the first. And that was a case that was directly precedented by this particular one. So interesting, right? Anyway, I just thought it would be fun to talk about some of the major cases that she was a part of and that she made a difference in. And just I thank her for everything that she did for our country and for caregivers everywhere, and that she cared enough to fight for the little person and people that couldn't fight for themselves, and that she gave caregivers equality You can be a caregiver and be male, and that's okay. And she fought for women to have equal pay, which I thought was amazing. And she just did a lot of things throughout her time as a lawyer and a Supreme Court justice to change our nation, I think, for the better. So anyway, again, this didn't have a whole lot to do with dementia today, but I really liked Ruth Bader Ginsburg and will miss her terribly. And I hope we get someone in her place that is equally as passionate about Americans and our fairness and our equality as she always was. So with that, I will see you next week on Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
You've been listening to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. To learn more about her resources, services, classes, or to book speaking engagements, visit Jill's website at summitresiliencetraining.com. A new podcast drops every Tuesday, so join us as we learn more about dementias, resilience, and overcoming obstacles to find a positive outcome. Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz can be found on your favorite podcast provider. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. Musical and technical support provided by Brian Hunter. See you next week.